Hello, my love. Welcome to the Fairly Bold podcast. My name is Eugenia, but you can call me E. And to give you an introduction for today's episode, I need to give you a little sneak peek behind my production process. So if I'm doing an interview, which is what we have this week, I first record the interview. I have a call with my guest and it's a regular conversation. And then after we have the conversation, I record the intro and the outro. So it's not a linear process. I don't record the intro and then the conversation, and then after the conversation, I record the outro. The reason is that I like to let the interview evolve and really become its own thing, because of course I do have an outline. I'm super prepared with the questions and where I want to take the interview. But the fun of a podcast is that there are so many unexpected conversations that happen outside of the outline. So when I'm doing an interview, of course, I'm in the interviewer role, which means that I want to learn more about the guest. I really want to bring out the best in their story and what's most relevant about the topic, and just make the guest feel comfortable so they can provide a lot of value to everyone who's listening. So I listen carefully to see where I can go deeper. It's a different type of listening. It's very engaging in conversation. But when you are the listener, you just sit back and enjoy. And you can take all the information in. There's not immediate feedback happening. Of course, you can then go leave a review. But in the moment, you are just listening and taking in the information. So you can take a little bit more time to process these ideas. So when I did this interview, I loved it, of course. I knew it was going to be amazing because Michelle, my guest today, is amazing. So I wasn't surprised by her answers. But truth be told, I wasn't expected to be as shocked as I was when I was editing and when I was the listener to the interview. Because the way Michelle has to really elaborate on her ideas and to really grab a concept and make it super clear for everyone in such a kind and fun and loving way. And as I said, I've talked to her before, so I kind of knew her personality and what to expect in that sense. But it's different when it's a podcast and you just edit and sit back and just take in the amazing information. So I am really proud of giving you this interview today because it's really valuable. With this podcast, I do my best to go beyond the fluff of, you know, positive, encouraging messages that are not deep and are not anchored in anything deep and really don't give you tools to actually improve your leadership, your relationships, in your femininity. I do my best to keep the fluff at minimum. Maybe my intros, now that I think about it, is the fluffiest part of the episode. So that's why I am particularly proud about this one. My guest today is Michelle Grosser. She's a wife, she's a mom, a lawyer, a woman of faith, a daughter, a sister. She's a volunteer helping teach a premarital class. She wears so many hats. And in my opinion, people that wear too many hats, they either A, go crazy, or B, become geniuses because their brain becomes efficient at thinking because they have so many things to do, they don't have time to waste. So definitely in Michelle's case, she has gone for option B. She's really, really smart and a voice that you really want to keep going back to for your relationships. Listen to this interview until the end. There's not a minute to waste. We talked about Michelle's background, her journey, the importance of building a strong foundation. She shared a scientific formula for romantic love. Okay, technically it's not really a formula, but there is scientific evidence of the three components of romantic love. And knowing those elements gives us tools to really keep love alive in long-term relationships. So we've discussed short-term relationships before or dating, and you can go back to that episode, but this is an episode for long-term relationships. Because it's different. Our mindset is different, what we allow is different, our commitment is different. So we kinda need the same principles, but we need to go a little bit deeper for long-term relationships. Speaking of commitment, we also talked about the fear of commitment and this increasing fear of committing to anything. in women's life, and also knowing when it's time to break up a long-term relationship. So much more. I truly think you're gonna love this one. So we are back with Michelle Grosser. As I said, I am so excited about this interview because I know that you guys love relationship talk, and I can give you a lot of failed relationship tips and dating tips, but I'm not the best when it comes to long-term relationship and just new at this marriage situation. So I brought the expert, Michelle. She's so smart, so feminine, so sweet, so talented, so kind. Michelle, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure. I'm so excited to be a part of it.
I was talking about before this interview about how you wear so many hats. You are a lawyer, you're a mom, you're a wife, you're a servant leader at church, you're a believer, you're a daughter. So how do you introduce yourself these days?
Oh, that's a good question. I do wear a lot of hats, I guess. My favorite hats are being a wife and a mom. I have two young girls. Amory is 3.5 and Ashton is 2. I am a lawyer. I have a practice in Coral Gables here in Florida. And then I'm really involved in my church too. That's really important to me. So on Tuesday nights, my husband and I teach a premarital course. I lead a small group in our church. We call those our VU crews. I lead a Sunday team, our guest relations team. So that's been really fulfilling and really rewarding. And I'm a daughter. I am a sister. I'm the oldest of 5, so that in and of itself presents a lot of really cool dynamics. But it's been a journey through each of those roles, but it's been so much fun.
I was thinking about how I wanted to start this conversation because the more I read about you, I read that you have a background with legislation here in Florida, but I also wanted to talk about you, about your relationship. And I guess that what surprises me the most is that you've been with your husband for so long, yet when I see your resume, you've done very impressive things. So for how long have you been together, first of all, for our listeners, and how have you balanced having all of these achievements while still keeping our relationship for so long?
Yeah, that's a good question. Jeff and I started dating at the beginning of 2006, so it's been almost 15 years now. We worked together at the same restaurant. I was a bartender and he was the manager. So it was an office romance. It started as an office romance. We were married in 2009. So we've been married for over 11 years now. But the balance between that relationship and I think my personal, professional goals and objectives has really been founded in a partnership, I think, between Jeff and I. I'm so grateful that I haven't really ever felt like I've had to choose between one or the other, but it's been a journey in learning how to balance both of them through different seasons and having someone, you know, it's hard to go to work if you feel like you're being resented for that, but it's really joyful to go to work when you know that you're being encouraged and celebrated through your own professional career. And I think, you know, from the beginning, I never knew I wanted to be a lawyer. In undergrad, I studied PR, and I always thought I would end up in pro sports. I loved playing sports, and I was super passionate about it. And then I graduated in 2008, and it was a huge recession, and it was hard to get employment. I was working at the time at Harley Davidson. I went to school in Milwaukee, and that was super cool. So I stayed there for 3 years, but I was missing a little bit of fulfillment in my role there. So I decided to go to law school. There were no lawyers in my family. I didn't know any lawyers. I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't even know that you should study for the exam to get into law school. I just showed up one day and I was like, I want to do this. And I remember leaving and walking back to my apartment and I was just like, I feel like I blacked out. Like, I don't even know what happened in the last 4 hours. So it's been cool that Jeff's been there through the whole process, right? He's seen my interest in my professional life, and then he's seen the work that it's taken just to go through school and find a job, and then for the rhythm that I'm in now, having my own practice and having my own employees and the flexibility but challenges that brings, to just have him as a partner through it all has been really special.
I didn't know that you had that roller coaster of experience, and that makes you even so much more interesting. If you feel comfortable, and to the extent that you feel comfortable, what has been your biggest challenge with your relationship through this whole journey and ups and downs and zigzagging?
Yeah, I think for the most part, you know, Jeff and I have gone through some challenges that we've done a really good job at going through together. So like in our married life, we've been through 3 miscarriages. Those were always really trying times. 2 of them were before our first daughter was born. Wow. So I think all of the unknown that brings and the test of your faith, I think, is really interesting. But at those moments, you know, we were able to remain supportive and get through it stronger. But I think that like a struggle between the two of us, but you know, thinking back for me, at least, I think the hardest time was after the birth of our first daughter. I think, you know, when I think back, it was only 3.5 years ago, but I think we had done a really good job preparing for having a baby. You know, we had everything we need. We read all the books. We took all the courses. You know, I had all the apps on my phone, but really I think we did a poor job at preparing for the transition in our roles as mom and dad. And I think, you know, the obvious stress of having a newborn in the house, you know, that goes unsaid. Everyone knows about that. But I think losing sight of taking care of yourself and how important that is to the dynamic of your relationship, I think I lost sight of that. And I think that there wasn't enough grace being passed around, and there was a lot of unspoken and unmet expectations, and that caused resentment. I think I probably, you know, if I'm honest with myself, probably went through a period of postpartum depression that I didn't even know I was going through. So those were really tough times. Like, I had always wanted a big family. I grew up in a big family, so I was so excited to have this baby. And then to have the baby, but then feel like what just happened to my marriage was such, you know, to be such a high and such a low. But man, we got through it. There were rough moments. I remember sitting down one night with Jeff, the baby was sleeping, and we're like, what are we even doing? Like, are we, is this even our marriage anymore? Like, how do we make this work? Because it feels so different than it did just 6 months ago or just a year ago. But man, those times come. And I think, you know, if you have the commitment there, like we had decided a long time ago that we're just not a couple who contemplates divorce. It's nothing we ever talk about. It's something we allow ourselves to think about. So if that's where you're at, then you're only left with one option, right? Which is to work it out. And we both want to. And I think that's really important. So that kind of got us through it. And now, thankfully, the kids are older and we're all getting more sleep. And we've learned so much from that experience. But that was tough.
I love that the woman that's listening right now, that probably like me, she grew up with Happily Ever After Cinderella, and they get together and they're happy forever. It hasn't been your case, but it looks like you had a very solid foundation. And maybe someone who's listening, that person wanna have what you have in the sense of that stability and that commitment. So what happens in those first early moments once you decide that you want to be with that person? Then you are not engaged yet, you're not married yet, but you decide that you want to build a relationship, because that's a choice. I always think that it's so funny how people think that they're going to wake up one day and they're going to feel like, who was it, Snow White, who opened the blinds singing with birds? It doesn't happen like that. So once the honeymoon and that initial excitement is over, what were some things that you did to make sure that you build that healthy foundation long term?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, you know, even like before we got married, we were really intentional about our wedding being about our marriage and not about our wedding. And like, I did not, you know, I don't even remember if my bridesmaids had, like, they didn't have matching dresses. They didn't, you know, those weren't the details of the day that I really cared about, right? Because I was so excited to marry Jeff, not to have that day of the wedding. And I think that I think a lot of people lose sight of that. Even our guest list, you know, I was young, I was 23 when we got married. And I think that at that moment, you know, I'm just grateful that we had the insight to, even our wedding guests, we had talked about it and we're like, we want people here to witness this day who we believe that in 10 years we can call at 2 a.m. because we're having, you know, relationship issues, and they're going to be there and rooting for our marriage and supportive of our marriage and there to get us through. So that meant that a lot of, you know, bartenders that I had worked with weren't coming to the wedding, or a lot of, you know, friends at the time weren't coming. And we had a small wedding, but man, to this day, like, those are the people that are really invested in our marriage. And I think that's really powerful. But yeah, that honeymoon phase, it's fun, and I don't think it should be diminished. I think it's so important to the start of a relationship to have that spark and that passion and that fire. But I think it's also important to have a realistic understanding that that's not sustainable. And that doesn't mean that it has to go away completely, but it's going to change. And I think expecting and embracing the change and planning for the change is a lot more powerful than having anxiety about that upcoming change or fear of that change and what that's going to lead to. And early on in our marriage, you know, we would talk about it quite a bit, but it was so cool because what we felt like might have been diminishing, maybe for lack of a better word, that passion or honeymoon side, man, what we were gaining in intimacy and our story and like what I consider to be like that strong foundation of love that, because you have that honeymoon phase maybe with more than one person, right? You've dated other people, you've had those butterflies, you've had a great first date with more people than your spouse. But I haven't had the type of intimacy I have with Jeff with any other human being. And I think you can't lose sight of the power of that. And that's the goal. And that's what needs to be cultivated. And that's what needs to grow, because that's really beautiful. And that's not fleeting.
You talk about intimacy, and I remember something that completely changed my life when we took your premarital, well, it's not your premarital class, but you were facilitating the class with your husband, Jeff, and you talked about the formula, quote unquote, for love, because love is so different for everyone, and it has three components. It was life-changing for me, and I would love for you to speak on it, because it gives people actual tools to look at specific issues or points in the relationship that are not working, could be improved, or maybe this is not the place for me. Talk about them, please.
Yeah, it's great. So I think scientists have, you know, since the dawn of man, have studied so many things, but they haven't really studied romantic love until recently. So these researchers at Yale did this big longitudinal study about romantic love. And what they essentially discovered is what they called, I guess, the triangular theory of love. And that romantic love in particular boils down to three components. So those three components are intimacy, passion, and commitment. And then they kind of talked through what each of those components means and how it relates to the relationship. So passion is, you know, just that, the hormonal aspect, right? It's biological. It's nothing that we really control. It's just a feeling that rises up in us, and maybe we can't even explain why we feel the passion for someone. So that's the first part. The initial part is that passion that we feel. And then the second component, you know, the second side of that triangle is the intimacy. And that's the emotional component. That's the connection that we feel with the other person. That's feeling known and feeling safe, you know, understanding that you can communicate in a way that's true and real, and that someone else is going to hear you and understand you. It's that shared history, right? The longer that you're with someone, you have a greater intimacy with them. You see it a lot with people that go through things together, right? Whether it's like a team that wins a championship, or whether it's friends that go through, you know, maybe some traumatic accident together or something like that. There's an intimacy there because there's such a shared experience. And then the third part of that triangle, and what I think is the base, right, is the commitment. And the commitment part is the willful part. That's the part where you're making a decision, where you're choosing romantic love. And I think even to break that down a little further, you know, there's the macro commitment where it's like, I choose you and you're my person, and I'm not going to be, you know, walking around and looking to the left or the right to see what other options there are or what else is available. I'm committed to you. But there's also like the micro part of that. That's the everyday, every moment choice to be committed to someone. And that might have to do, you know, with your tone or your attitude or the way that you're showing love, all those little decisions that are willful, a willful component of that commitment. And I think one of the biggest, you know, results of this study is just a reinforcement of how fluid that love is. So it kind of leads us back to the discussion we were having about the transition from a honeymoon phase to what comes next. And it's just, you know, not having the anxiety or fear about that transition, but understanding that it's going to come, and understanding that, you know, you ask a couple who's been married a month, the level of satisfaction in their relationship on these three levels, and they're going to say 10 out of 10. You know, this is the best thing ever. We've got so much intimacy. We just got married and then went on this amazing honeymoon and we've been together for 3 years and all this stuff. And then, you know, commitment's great. You know, I've never been more committed to this person. I wear this ring now. It's a big deal. And the passion is still there, but you know, come back 3 months, come back 3 years, come back 30 years. Is it 10 out of 10? Maybe not. But what I find hope in is that the satisfaction, it really doesn't have to decrease if you learn how to cultivate those three components and just communicate about them. You know, in the Symbis course, that prenatal course that we facilitate, they talk about just, you know, maybe once a month or once a quarter or something, sit down with your spouse, draw a little bar graph with those three points, you know, and rate it. For intimacy, I'm feeling a 4 out of 10. For passion, I'm feeling a 2 out of 10. For commitment, I'm feeling an 8 out of 10, or, you know, whatever it is on your personal level, and share them with your partner. And I think that's a great way to make sure that you're aware of where your partner's at. And if you're feeling low or depleted or unsatisfied in one of those three pillars, you know, the first step is to identify it. And then you can address it, right? So if you're not feeling like, I'll speak for myself, I know after pregnancy, I gained a ton of weight. I wasn't sleeping. I was trying to breastfeed. Like, passion was at a zero for me. It was not happening. I did not feel good about myself. But I think that for Jeff to not know that and for me to not communicate that, you don't want him to get in his head, like, is she not attracted to me anymore? Is, you know, whatever all these things are that lead to these miscommunications that can cause you know, real issues in a marriage.
Do you feel like you should approach these three components the same way in a long-term relationship as you do in a marriage? For example, let's say you've been with someone for 3 years and you don't feel that excitement to be with them anymore. You see them as a friend. Should you fight for the relationship because you've been together for so long? Because I know when in a marriage is different, because a marriage, you already made the commitment for life. But when you are dating, I feel like this is a constant struggle where, hey, we've been together for so long. We've already built so many memories. We do have that sense of intimacy and story together. I'm not feeling, something doesn't feel right, but is it normal? Should I fight for this or should we just break up and just find a new person? And I feel like that translates into people being afraid of marriage at the same time because they don't wanna be hyper committed and reach a point where they regret their decision. So how do you approach those components different in dating and marriage?
Yeah, I think the commitment level is different in dating and marriage, right? I know for me, as a person of faith, my marriage is a covenant, and that's a completely different commitment than in a dating relationship or even being engaged. So I think they are different, but I don't think that difference in and of itself makes a distinction between how you should respond to these sorts of things. And I think that, you know, fighting for a relationship, I mean, man, an investment like that in a relationship, in a friendship, in a business decision, like whatever it is, your emotional investment, your mental investment, your maybe a financial investment, like that's really hard to walk away from. And that requires, you know, for me, that would require a lot of prayer and a lot of requests for discernment and understanding. But I think that, you know, one of the most toxic mind frames that we can have is to just tell ourselves, you know, this is the way we do it because this is the way we've done it. And to feel like you're comfortable or complacent or for the fear of what would come or the what ifs if you would change something, right? Because that can be really uncomfortable. But man, like fighting for a relationship in the dating stage that just isn't working, it's not going to get better. Like marriage is not going to make whatever's broken now get better. And trust yourself. Like there, you know when there's red flags, trust your intuition. Are you making excuses that deep down you know you shouldn't be making, you know, inexcusable behavior, excusable? And in dating especially, like it's really not supposed to be that hard. I was kind of thinking about this and I was like, you know, I give marriage the respect it deserves. But I think when people talk about, you know, marriage is so hard or it's so challenging or it's such, you know, it's difficult. Yes. But I think the part of that that's supposed to be challenging is that we're challenged to be selfless and giving in a way that doesn't really feel natural, right? That's a good kind of difficulty. I'm making myself better for someone else so I can serve someone else. But if the difficulty is that, you know, we're always fighting about petty things, or, you know, I feel resentment about this that I just can't get over, or I'm being disrespected, or, you know, if those are the types of challenges you're facing, and they're not getting better, you know, sometimes there's that's the sign, right? Sometimes you're sitting there asking for a sign, but the fact that it's been bad for 6 months and unhealthy for a year, and it's not getting better, and you're not on the same page, and you don't share a vision, and that in and of itself can be the sign that it's time to move on. And I don't know if we've all seen that picture where there's like a little girl with a small teddy bear, and she's like holding it up, and it's this picture of depiction of God, I guess, or something. And like, she doesn't want to give up this small little toy that she has, but behind his back, he just has something so much better for her. And I think that until we're willing to trust in that process and know that there's something better out there, you know, there's a lot of comfort that can come from that in such a huge transition.
What would be some red flags that could come on later in the relationship, at least from your perspective? Because if someone's listening to this and they're paying a lot of attention to this part, they're probably not comfortable in their relationship and they're already questioning. So what are things that we should pay attention to, and what are things that are not necessarily a good indicative? Because at the beginning, it's easier. You know, if the guy cancels you, like cancels on you the last minute, you know that he doesn't have commitment. If the guy is very disrespectful, you know those things early on. But then once you move forward, it's like you accept those things. So what are some red flags that come up later on that in your perspective are or should be non-negotiable?
Yeah, it's great. I think, and I think you're right. I think there's the obvious ones that, right, that we have to be really aware of and not ignoring and brushing to the side, because those are real. And I think in the context of a long-term relationship that's a marriage, those will just be exacerbated and blown up. But I think some of the red flags that would really, you know, make me cautious is, how do we fight? You know, I think one of the biggest indicators of the success of a relationship is not what we fight about, it's not how often we fight, but it's how we fight, right? And I think that is
good. I love that.
Yeah, I think that's great. So how do you fight? Do you fight in a way that's fair? Do you fight in a way that's respectful? You can express your opinions without being critical. You can express how you're feeling without attacking. One of the biggest things that I've had to learn is how to fight or even just communicate without being offended. Like, that's something that has given me so much freedom when I've discovered that it's a choice about whether I feel offended or not, right? I can choose not to be offended. So I think that's something I would put a lot of time and thought into. I think, you know, there's other things. Your commitment level. Are you in the same place? You know, I have, you know, some really good friends of mine who've been together for 7-8 years, and she's just waiting for him to propose and he's not proposing. And she says, I want to get married, and he's not proposing. And you know, how does that, you know, where, if your commitment levels are in different places, you know, no one wants to wait forever. And I think that in and of itself can bring resentment and other issues. Do you have a shared vision for your family, for your future, for your faith life, for your personal goals and your professional goals? Do you have a shared vision in that? If one person wants to do, you know, live a missionary lifestyle, very minimalistic, traveling the world with no children, that's, you know, that's going to rub in a wrong way with someone who wants to settle down and have family in a more, you know, traditional upbringing for that family. So those are things that are real, and those are things that I don't think you should minimize and think, you know, we'll work through it in the future. Like, no, those are conversations that you have to have now. And just general communication skills, like, there's so much tied to that. And when I say skills, maybe that's not even the right word, because I think communication is a journey. Learning how to communicate better, learning how to communicate with that particular person is a journey. But just the manner in which you communicate with each other, the trust that's there, the honesty that's there, the respect that's there. Those are things, you know, you decide what's non-negotiable for you. For me, that's, you know, I don't want to be, and these might seem petty, but it's important. Like, I don't want to be micromanaged by my husband. I don't want to be ever spoken to in a condescending tone by my husband. I don't. So these are things that, like, if someone spoke to me like that, it's not going to work, you know? So figure out what for you is non-negotiable. And I mean really non-negotiable, like not like something like, you know, sometimes he puts something red in with the whites in the laundry. Like that's not really what I'm talking about here, but the things that are really important to you and, you know, take stock of that. There are certain things that you don't need to, and that you shouldn't compromise on. And I think that those, if you feel like you're compromising, those should be red flags to you.
I love that you talk about commitment, because I'm just reading the book by Tim Keller, The Meaning of Marriage. And he says that traditionally, before, for 1700 years, the masculine man was a man who was very committed and self-disciplined. And then it came this view of self-love and freedom and do what you want. And now for some reason, there's this view that men should have a lot of women and a lot of options. And now I feel like that's rubbing in women a little bit, where we are approaching that side of negative masculinity where we are super afraid to commit because we don't want nothing to stand on our way. So what is our issue with commitment and committing to a long, lifelong relationship, a family, of marriage? Why do you think we are so afraid? Maybe it's my perspective. Do you think we are becoming more afraid of commitment? Do you think we are being too complacent with the fear of commitment that many men show? What has been your experience, especially since you work with so many couples?
I think part of it is just a product of the age in which we live, right? Like we have choices about everything. I was actually listening to something the other day, and they were talking about this concept of analysis paralysis, where we're just given so many choices that we're literally paralyzed and that we can't choose. And I think that in a lot of cases, choices are really important and empowering. But I think there have to be areas of your life where you have a choice. And once you make a decision, there's power in the commitment to that decision. And I think that a lot of times, you know, I think the construct of marriage has just been skewed in so many ways. And I think people's personal views and experiences with maybe, you know, watching their parents or other couples that they've seen being, you know, going through a long-term marriage, uncles, aunts, you know, whomever, I can see how that can look unattractive or unappealing or boring. And I think that when you're in your early 20s, and if you're associating that with the concept of marriage and thinking that that's what you're signing up for, I can see how that's really daunting, and it's a lot easier to just keep your options open. But I think that if you're coming from it with the maturity that marriage requires, I think that you understand that marriage is one of the most fun things you could experience in your whole life. You know, marriage is exciting. It's what you make of it. So I don't think that there's anything blah or blasé about it. But I think that there's just such a misconception about what it means to be committed, and the fear that, you know, that might end up in something that's just gray, and no one wants to live in that gray. But I think we miss out on the beauty and the power we hold into making that marriage really exciting and fun and fulfilling. I think there's just so much power in it as a couple, but even personally, like there's, you know, the Bible talks about iron sharpening iron, and that's not just with our platonic relationships. Like that's especially with our romantic relationships that we're making. It's an opportunity for someone to know us better than anyone else that makes us better and pushes us to grow in all of these different areas. So, you know, while I can understand some of the hesitation, and I think that's appropriate. I think that we should have, you know, my pastor Don Cherie preached this sermon this last week, and she talked about having a reverent fear. And that's just, that phrase has just been on my mind because it's so true. Like I think things that deserve our respect are God, you know, being a mom to two kids, being a wife to Jeff. Like I'm confident in my role, but I also have a reverent fear of the importance of each of those roles, and a reverent fear that I have to give it my all and take it so seriously because it's so precious and so important. So I think that not wanting to just jump into your first relationship and get married is a healthy, good thing. But I think that you have to get over the fear that it's going to become boring, or that, you know, I think it's really immature to think that you might be missing out on something else, right? You always are. I don't know what it's like to be married to anyone else. But man, if that's your focus, like life is going to be rough. You know, that's available, you know, every vacation you take, you know, every whatever you have for breakfast, you could have had something else that would have been better. But that's not a way to live life, thinking about those other opportunities. It's about pouring into where you're at and really being committed and making it the best. And that's more fulfilling than just having the option and you know, in some things, especially marriage.
I love that. And I would like to know if you think that there's a feminine way to approach these topics of marriage and commitment. And femininity is one of those words that everyone means something different. So for you, do you think there's a way, a feminine way to do it?
I think so. And I think that's what's so, you know, one of the things that's so cool about your podcast is I think that that's a voice that really needs to be heard and a topic that needs to be discussed, because I'll be frank, I hadn't really put much thought into it before listening to your podcast, you know, thinking about it for this particular episode. But, you know, we all know that femininity has this objective, you know, Webster's definition. But I think that, you know, one of the biggest challenges that it faces is that so many of us, when we think of femininity, we think of that, like, legally blonde, you know, high heels, frilly, pink, like, ditzy, not particularly sharp or bright. And I think that's such a travesty because, you know, my faith leads me to believe that, you know, God created men and women for a purpose. We're not all the same. I think about even just in my marriage, like with my two kids, you know, Jeff and I love them so intensely, but in such different ways. And a lot of that is because of our genders. So I think that, you know, finding what femininity means to you and how that construct applies to you as a person, I think is important. Like, if femininity to you is that legally blonde, you know, construct, and it's important for you to have, you know, your nails done and your lashes done and your hair done, own it. And if femininity to you means having, you know, a really nurturing spirit and pouring into those that are around you, own that. If femininity means bringing, you know, a certain sensitive side to your business or, you know, whatever it is, I think that one of the most attractive things about a person is their confidence, right? It's just owning it. And I don't even mean attractive in like the romantic construct. Like, if you're, you know, with friends or as a Jesus follower, people being interested in the lifestyle that you lead and wanting to know more, I think that, you know, it's about that confidence. So I think finding the way to be confident in your femininity, whatever that means, is really powerful. And I think there's a place for that in a marriage, just like there's a place for masculinity in a marriage. And there's such a broad spectrum of both of those terms, but finding the way that works for your relationship and what, you know, how you play into that partnership and how you use the pros and the strengths of femininity and masculinity, I think they're meant to work together. So I think it's really powerful.
I love that. And I wish we had more time, but I have a million other questions to ask you. I feel like I'm going to have every single guest back on. I've just decided it's going to be the same people all over again, because I'm so obsessed about my guests that I vet them so thoroughly that I want to ask them like a 2-hour podcast. But thank you so much, Michelle, for your time, for your wisdom, and for giving us permission to be the feminine way that we want and taking away so many of those fears that we feel like we need to become a certain look. Whether you like Legally Blonde, whether for you femininity is Cardi B, whatever, we feel like we have to be a prototype, and you gave the audience permission to be their own feminine type, and I love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for
pleasure.
Listening.
Thank you for
Please
having
me. Please go to fairlybold.com for today's blog post. I will have all the resources mentioned there, including the research that came up with these three components of romantic love. Your feedback truly means the world to me. And in the world of podcasts, reviews are huge. YouTube, they have the algorithm, so it's kind of different. We are in crazy land. We have nothing but reviews to make our show grow. So I would be forever thankful if you could just take 2 minutes to subscribe and review this podcast. If you're listening from an iPhone, you click on the name of the show. You know, when you're listening to the actual episode, you go back to what would be the home screen of the show itself on the podcast app. And When you land in that kind of homepage, which is where you see all the episodes, you scroll down and then you're gonna see the 5 stars. Then you hit the 5 stars because I hope that you love the show and write about how much you like it, how much it has helped you, and truly an honest review so people, when people find it, they can go to their reviews and they get excited and iTunes also gets the message that we're doing a good job here. And if you're on Spotify, they don't do reviews as far as of today. I hope they come out with that feature soon. But on Spotify, the best thing you can do is subscribe by hitting the follow button. Up also in the what would be the homepage of the show, you hit follow as if you were following an artist, and that is really, really gonna help the show grow. The better my reviews or and the more people listen to this, the better the quality of the content I can produce. So please, if you have the time, I would really appreciate it. And I'm so, so thankful, really, that you stayed here, and I can't wait to see you again next week.